For the week of August 14th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 115, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
How are you doing, Michael?
I'm doing great.
Anything new and exciting to report over at the Huffington Post?
They got in a bit of a fracas for doing an online contest to let somebody design their logo for the HuffPost political section. They said, hey, who wants, we'll have a contest, you can do it, and you'll get all the exposure and visibility. And graphic designers all around the web went crazy, as well they should, and said, you're one of the biggest sites in the world to ask people to do that for free for a wildly successful business like yours as part of this gigantic media empire is insulting to graphic designers and offensive, and you should stop it immediately. Huffington Post's reaction is like, well, that's what we do with everything.
Yeah, I was just going to say, they kind of do that with everybody they work with on a content basis.
They do, and yet the designers are angry.
You know, I just don't know who would ever create content for free, ever.
I'm also in the midst of Fringe Fest New York, which is an annual festival, sort of like the Edinburgh Festival over in the UK, where there are about 200 shows being mounted in New York over about 2.5 weeks. They're just all over the place, mostly downtown, small shows, new playwrights, young talent. You know, it's always a crapshoot, but it's fun. You see 2-3 shows a day sometimes, and hopefully you find one or two shows or maybe one or two actors or one or two directors or writers that have talent and, you know, may actually develop into something. And every once in a while, of course, a show breaks out like You're in Town, which made it to Broadway and even won Tony Awards, had its start in Fringe Fest. So that's a lot of fun.
Well, you'll have to tell us how you know, what you find this year down at Fringe Fest. And by the way, I was not commenting on people creating free content by referring to you. I was referring to both of us creating.
Yes, for the podcast.
Yes, exactly. And speaking of podcasts, a little bit later on this podcast, we'll be talking to Larry Roeder of the New York Times, who is going to fill us in on how the record industry is bracing itself for a battle with songwriters and artists over copyright issues. Disney has pulled the plug on the Lone Ranger movie, which was to star Johnny Depp. We have the latest news about AMC, the most acclaimed and troubled network in town. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Yes, and as always, we're telling you about the worldwide box office. The number one movie around the world this weekend was The Smurfs, which grossed $73.5 million worldwide. It's at $242 million total and counting. Number two around the world was Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which grossed another $68 million worldwide. It's at $180 million and counting. Number three is Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. That grossed another $37 million worldwide. At number four is The Help, which grossed $25.5 million worldwide over the weekend. That's basically a U.S.-only release and definitely the biggest news in the U.S. box office, where it was ranked number two, right behind Planet of the Apes. It opened on Wednesday. It made $10 million total on Wednesday and Thursday. It got good reviews. It has good word of mouth. It's reaching a lot of people. So The Help is at $35 million total after a five-day opening week. And it's definitely one of the success stories of the end of the summer and looks like it might have legs for a few weeks to come.
Well, and see, what you're saying is The Help needs no help.
That's right. I think I told you this. Albert Brooks, the comedian, does a Twitter feed. And The Help, of course, is a movie about maids in the South in the 50s, I believe is the era that we're talking about. A writer comes to town and starts to interview the maids. And as she tells their stories, it creates a lot of tension and excitement between the domestics and the women who employ them, who like to think they're their friends, but aren't always that sensitive to their situation. So that's the setup of the movie. And Albert Brooks posted a tweet that said, it simply said, I hear The Help isn't playing on Thursdays. Which, if you've ever had a maid or know anybody who has a maid, that's very funny because the maid's day off is almost always on Thursday. So that's just
I didn't get it because I don't have a maid, although my butler
is staying. Somebody who was a domestic. That's a very funny joke. At number five in the box office worldwide is Captain America, which grossed $19 million. That's at $285 million worldwide and counting. At number six, another movie that opened basically in the U.S. only is Final Destination 5, the sequel to the final episode of Final Destination, which at Final Destination 4, we were told it was the end, but of course it's not. It grossed $18.4 million. At number seven, Cowboys and Aliens, $14.6 million worldwide. That's really, That's only at $88 million worldwide so far.
Well, has it opened in all territories? I mean, that is a very low number.
It's got a long way to go, but it's definitely not doing well anywhere. Then is Green Lantern. That's at $14 million worldwide. Transformers, $13.8 million. Cars 2 is down there towards the bottom. That goes to another $13.4 million worldwide. It's at $476 million and counting. That passes the original Cars, but it's still one of the lowest Pixar films in over a decade. 30 Minutes or Less, another movie that opened basically in the U.S., got very poor reviews. It stars Jesse Eisenberg. It grossed $13 million. And then Super 8, which is long gone from the U.S. screens, but it grossed $9.5 million worldwide.
So that's coming in at number 12 then, Super 8.
That's right. And it grossed $220 million and counting for a movie that costs $50 million to make. Now, in the U.S., at number 11, way back there, is Glee, the concert film, which grossed $6.9 million worldwide. It had a few hundred thousand dollars overseas, but basically most of that money comes from its U.S. opening, where it grossed $5.7 million in North America. Let's talk about it. As you joked at the top that Glee, the concert film, is a disaster.
Did I joke at the top? I did? Oh, I didn't realize I had joked at the top about Glee, the concert movie, being a disaster. But, you know, let me just...
You said it was even lower than the Jonas Brothers film.
Oh, okay. You're looking at our show notes. I was just copying and pasting from other outlets such as Box Office Mojo and Box Office Profit. But yes, it did open lower than the Jonas Brothers 3D concert experience, which opened to $12.5 million among comparable titles.
Right. And most people say, oh my God, what a disaster that is. But again, they have to remember this is a concert film. Glee, the concert film, is already one of the 10 highest grossing concert films in history. These movies do not make a lot of money. So to say that Glee is a flop, as many people did, because it grossed $5.7 million in the U.S., is ignorant.
Yes, but when you look at the top 10 concert films of all time, we have Justin Bieber came out earlier this year. It made $73 million, and of course it had that nice 3D boost. We had Michael Jackson's This Is It. I don't think that was in 3D. No, it wasn't. But again, released in the past 2 years. Hannah Montana, also recent. When you start going down the list, you get to U2 Rattle and Hum at number 7, or Madonna Truth or Dare at number 5 with $15 million, or Stop Making Sense, the Talking Heads film, at number 9 with $5 million. Those are all films that opened pre-2000, in some cases, pre-1990.
There's plenty of movies that came out as concert films that didn't make any money in the 2000s. Concert films don't make money. Again, the top three movies of all time are outliers. $73, $72, and $65 million. The fourth biggest film of all time is The Jonas Brothers, which grossed $90 million. So you need to say, well, wait a second. If I'm expecting a concert film to make more than $5 or $10 million, I have ridiculous expectations. Concert films by The Rolling Stones and Bruce Springsteen and The Who and Led Zeppelin, guess what? They're not on the list because they didn't make any money. And some of them were released in the last 20 years or 10 years. Concert films don't make money. This is not about adjusting for inflation. Movies where you show a person in concert performing songs, the vast majority of them throughout history have made less than a couple million dollars.
Well, I mean, even if you adjust for inflation, what, U2 Rattle and Hum, I think that was a 1987-88 release. I mean, even if you double it, you're only at $16 million. So,
well, U2 3D came out in the last few years. And that grossed $10 million. That's the sixth biggest film of all time. So look at the genre you're looking at, look at the track record, and if you say, gee, this movie's a flop, it's already in the top 10. It's not a flop. It's grossed more than almost every concert film in history. Doesn't matter when they were released, it grossed more. So put a little perspective.
Well, do you think that The Smurfs is a flop? I mean, I know it kind of, you know, battled for first place its first week out, but, you know, it's made $101 million. I don't think it's a flop. I know people are saying that it's a bad movie, but that's different than being a flop.
How much did it cost to make?
$110 million.
Right. So it's at $110 million and it's at $240 million worldwide. So we know they're not going to lose their shirts. It certainly didn't get good reviews. I would say based on how it does on DVD and merchandise sales, they may decide it's worthwhile doing a sequel. Why not? It's certainly not a flop.
What about Captain America, The First Avenger? You know they're going to do a sequel to this. It cost $140 million to make. It's already made $157 million here in the United States and Canada. And overseas, it's made $285 million.
Worldwide.
Okay, good point. Worldwide, yes.
Captain America, the sequel to Captain America is The Avengers, the big movie. They're setting up this film with all these superhero characters, Iron Man, the Hulk, Captain America, and all the rest. So they're all going to appear in this one superhero movie in which they all team together to fight evil. So in a sense, that is the sequel, and they're building anticipation for that film by making Thor and Captain America. So I think they're going to – they've made this movie. It's done well. They're not losing their shirt. Then they make the Avengers, and they see how that does, and then they'll see how it falls and, you know, how they feel 3 years from now as to whether they want to make another Captain America or another Avengers or what they're going to do. I don't know, but – clearly, they're setting up this big movie, and they needed to introduce these characters like Thor and Captain America, who rarely, if ever, have been on the big screen. So, you know, that's their job. They accomplished it without losing their shirt. They may make a little money, and everybody's happy.
Well, and then there's Final Destination 5, which I agree with you. I thought the fourth film was the final film. Apparently, they needed more money, and it opened on 4,600 screens, and it earned 75% of its gross from 3D presentations. So,
yeah, if you went to this movie, you saw it in 3D.
That's right, yeah. So that kind of helps the 3D cause a little bit.
That's actually why I got suckered into seeing Final Destination 4, because it was in 3D. And I thought, well, that could be fun, and it wasn't. But there you go. But yeah, as long as they keep making money, they'll keep making the movies. And let me blow your mind now. Glee, the concert film, is a flop. Yes, it's one of the 10 highest grossing concert films of all time, but they spent $9 million to make that movie. And if you're going to spend $9 million to make a movie in a category where that means it has to be the fifth biggest film of all time just to break even, you're kind of stupid. That's like saying making a movie for $800 million in the general box office.
I would love to see the accounting on that, because they were on tour anyway. So they basically just shot one of the concerts. How did they spend $9 million shooting a concert that was already being performed anyway? So, you look at the accounting, and I'm sure every last little screw and hammer and nail that the concert needed was charged back to the movie.
I'm sure you're right. I don't know what the – oh, to downplay the cost of the tour, to sort of subsidize the tour. Is that what you mean?
I guess. I don't know how you spend $9 million making
maybe the director or, you know, a big-name director or the editing. They wanted to make it quick. You know, who knows?
Who knows?
You know, they wanted a quick turnaround. You know, it was that costs money. I agree with you. Concert film shouldn't cost that much money. If you're making a concert film, you shouldn't spend $9 million because chances are you're not going to make it back. And depending on how this film does in DVD and, you know, give it a couple weeks at the box office, it's likely, you know, it probably won't lose its shirt again. I'm getting a bit of a cliche there, but certainly not a good idea to make a movie at a budget that means it has to be the sixth biggest film of all time in that category just to match the budget. You're clearly not being very smart.
Do you know who agrees with you?
Who?
Disney. They believe that you shouldn't make these huge, monstrous, big-budget films, even for titles that kind of have a built-in audience, like, say, off the top of my head, The Lone Ranger.
Yeah, this is fascinating. They pulled the plug on The Lone Ranger franchise. Johnny Depp signed up, I think, about 2 years ago to this project. Gore Verbinski was directing. Jerry Bruckheimer, who works with Johnny Depp, of course, on the Pirates movies, as did Gore on the first few. So this is the team behind Disney's biggest franchise of the moment, the Pirates of the Caribbean. Every one of them makes $1 billion. They're working together for a few years on The Lone Ranger, a massive property. Johnny Depp is going to play Tonto. The actor from The Social Network, who played the Winklevoss twins, is playing the Lone Ranger, so he doesn't cost a lot of money. And they just pulled the plug.
Yeah, and they had, like, I guess 60 people were already working in New Mexico. They had sets being built. They were, you know, fitting out the sound stages there in New Mexico. And they just said, you know what? $250 million? Not so much. We don't want it to cost that much.
A big blockbuster summer franchise movie, how much do you expect to spend? With the biggest star in the world at the moment, which I think is pretty arguable for Johnny Depp, and a franchise this big, how much do they think you can make it for? 150? I mean, it's a period film. It's a Western. It stars the biggest star in the world, the team behind their biggest franchise. I'm not quite sure about the logic of this.
Well, I don't know. I mean, do you think Cowboys and Aliens, which was opened this summer and didn't do very well, it was kind of a Western. I guess you would classify it as a Western. I mean, do you think that had any effect on Disney's decision or any influence?
Disney said it did, which to me is moronic. I mean, Cowboys and Aliens is this relatively unknown property. It's a weird amalgam of two different genres, Westerns and sci-fi, whereas The Lone Ranger is one of the most famous properties in history. Everybody knows The Lone Ranger. You don't have to sell it. It sells itself. So to compare the two is stupid. To say, well, that Western did bad, so we don't want to make this Western, that's also stupid. I mean, if you go by that logic, you'll never make a comedy, you'll never make a drama, you'll never make anything, because something will always flop and something will always do well. In my mind, since there are so few Westerns made, making a new Western, you're already up on the competition. It feels fresh and different. It's a Western. Great.
Right. Well, I mean, you had Gore Verbinski, the director, Jerry Bruckheimer, the producer, Johnny Depp, all teaming up again. Last time they did it, as you mentioned, Pirates of the Caribbean, that franchise made a little bit of money. You know, it kind of lined the pockets of Disney for a while. And yet, I guess Disney just felt like $250 million, a budget that high for this film, was not right. They wanted to bring it down to between $200 and $210 million. And of course, these are reported figures that the Hollywood Reporter is citing. I don't know how accurate they are.
Now, look at this. The question is, how much money they're going to lose by not making this movie? Well, Johnny Depp stars in Pirates. He hasn't committed to Pirates 5 yet. Does this anger him and make him less likely to make that movie with Disney? Johnny Depp also stars in Alice in Wonderland, which also grossed $1 billion, one of the 10 highest grossing films of all time worldwide. There, you could do a sequel to Alice in Wonderland, Alice Through the Looking Glass. Maybe Johnny Depp and Tim Burton maybe he doesn't want to play ball with Disney. Maybe he's angry that they killed his franchise. You know, Jerry Bruckheimer obviously is a big producer for them. He's been trying to launch hits and not had any success outside of Pirates for quite a while at the movies.
I mean, he had Prince of Persia, which just went nowhere.
Prince of Persia went nowhere. The Sorcerer's Apprentice with Nicolas Cage went nowhere. G-Force, the Hamsters movie, Confessions of a Shopaholic. He thought he had a franchise with National Treasure, but he killed that after just one movie.
One sequel.
Right. One sequel, I beg your pardon. Deja Vu with Denzel Washington. I mean, it's been a decade for anything other than Pirates, and that was Black Hawk Down back in 2001 and Remember the Titans before that. So Bruckheimer has not had a lot of success in movies in a while, but...
You know, when you really look at it, Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer worked together for, what, a decade or two?
Yeah.
And Don Simpson passed away quite unexpectedly due to a heart attack and left Jerry Bruckheimer to fend for himself. They were breaking up anyway. But, you know, Don Simpson was really the story guy there, and Jerry Bruckheimer was more the business guy. And so you see these movies are all business-like franchises, whether it's Pirates or G-Force. The stories, however, leave something to be desired, and that's the element that Don Simpson brought to that relationship.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, he died in 1995. January 19th, 1996.
Darn! Okay.
And of course, drugs were involved. Of course, it wasn't just a heart attack. It's a sad ending to his career. But that's a good point, that he was a good balance to Bruckheimer. But Bruckheimer has, even with Pirates, the story is not very strong. To me, what's most fascinating is how this may impact Disney's bottom line with all the other franchises that they have. And $250 million to launch a big summer movie just doesn't strike me as that much money. If it's a big flop with that brand name and Johnny Depp, you're going to make $300 million worldwide.
Well, what did you think about what The Hollywood Reporter had to say here about how they're basically saying that even though, you know, you can do these effects now that for relatively modest budgets, these big, giant visual effects, that they're looking at all of these upstarts like the Purchase Brothers and the folks who did Skyline, which was in 3D, and they're saying, well, why can that movie cost $9 million and look like it costs $250 million? And you're asking us for $250 million to make a movie that looks like it costs $250 million. You guys need to lower your budget and start doing a little bit of what some of these young upstarts are doing who have no budget.
Because they don't look like they cost $250 million. They look better than they should as B-movies, but they look like B-movies. If you look at Skyline or you look at, what was the other one? The Battle Los Angeles. You can see how they have very limited shots of big moments. They have actors in small settings. They hint at a lot of big stuff. And there's a couple key money moments. But by and large, no, they don't have the flash. They don't have the glamour. They don't have the big moments and the extensive special effects and sets that let you know this is a big movie. They're small movies, and it shows. They create a sense of excitement about them on a dime, but you can't do that with a big summer movie from a big studio with a big star.
So do you think
you can't make blockbuster franchises on the cheap?
Do you think they're trying to put pressure on some of these, like Gore Verbinski's, these A-list directors, to try and bring down their budgets?
I don't think so. I think they just added the numbers and decided this movie was not worth it. I don't know why, but they did, and they decided it was worth the risk of what they were going to do to all their other franchises, that all the other things they're in business with Johnny Depp and Gore Verbinski and Bruckheimer on. So,
well, they did the same thing with 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, or was it Captain Nemo? I don't know what they were actually calling that film, but they did the same thing there, and McGee was directing 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and they just pulled the plug, and they were already building sets on that one too. So,
well, it's better to pull the plug and not make a movie you don't believe in. But it does have ramifications when you've got a lot of other franchises that those same creative people are involved in and might get angry about. If you make The Lone Ranger for $250 million and lose $150 million on it total worldwide with all the marketing and all the costs, okay. But if he makes an Alice sequel and a pirate sequel, guess what? You've just got another $1.6 billion in profit to play with.
Well, that's a Disney decision, and that, I guess your projects are never safe at Disney.
Oh, golly. I don't know if you want to say that, but are your projects safe at AMC, the American Movie Classics, the TV channel that is one of the talks of Hollywood right now?
I think it's a little too early to tell. I mean, certainly they have given some shows that wouldn't normally make it on a broadcast network or even some cable networks, they've given them a shot.
But no, it's the hottest network around right now. It's hotter than HBO. They have Mad Men and Breaking Bad and The Killing, which got a lot of good reviews, and of course The Walking Dead. And they've had a string of other shows that didn't work that, you know, showed boldness and an attempt to create something new. They're winning the Emmys. They've got all the heat. They don't have a huge, huge blockbuster hit yet, though The Walking Dead could become that. But they are definitely the network that everybody else sort of wants to imitate right now.
So then where is all this turmoil coming from? Because I know you said that there's a lot of turmoil going on over at AMC. I know they went public earlier this year.
It's this constant fight between budgets, you know, the budget for a show and what they think the show can make down the road. You know, the artists want more money to make the show that they see in their head. And the studio says, that's too much money. We don't want to do it.
Wow. Okay. So really, it's just boiling down to money again. And really, I think if you take the long look at this, the long approach look, you kind of look and see, well, gee, record companies are making less, studios are making less. And yes, I know they're still making money. They're not poor, but they're just making less than they did using the same distribution channels than they had in the past. Maybe that's what AMC is looking at and saying, gee, we better protect ourselves here by not raising the budgets on these out of control.
That's true. But when you look at how much their revenue has increased now that they've invested in original programming and the cost of the programming, they're still way ahead in the black. And there seems to be a bizarre tension between them simply wanting to save pennies and, you know, deliver shows that are high quality. You know, you've got to spend a certain amount of money to make a show. But their travails have been so great that the New York Times just ran a breakdown of everything that's been going wrong on every single AMC show. It's a calendar from March 23rd through upcoming November, where they list all the problems that basically affect every single show they've made. They've had fights on Mad Men. They've had fights on people being unhappy about The Killing. They've had fights on The Walking Dead, and they have fights even coming up on shows that haven't even opened up yet. The first one is The Walking Dead. The Hollywood Reporter got the dirt on Frank Darabont, who was kicked from the show. They tried to pretend he was stepping down because it was too overwhelming for him, but of course he was fired. And it really upset the people on the show. It upset them. Basically, what it boiled down to was before the first episode aired, AMC renewed the show for a second season. And they said, we want to do another season, but we're going to lower the budget. Instead of, you know, I'm making up the numbers, but instead of $3.5 million, we want it to be $2.9 million.
Right. Darabont kind of said, hey, wait a second.
No, they said, well, all right, the show hasn't even opened yet. You want to show confidence in it. You're renewing it for a second season before the show aired. Okay. But they thought, we have no leverage. You know, we haven't even aired an episode yet. But they thought, once the show airs, if it works and everybody's happy, we'll be able to come back and say, hey, look, you know, you like the show because of the quality. We can't cut back by, you know, 15-20% and give you the same quality.
Well, they wanted to cut it $650,000 per episode.
So from about what?
Probably between 2 and 3 million.
Yeah. So what happened was the show aired to record ratings. It was a bigger hit than they could have ever imagined, much bigger than Breaking Bad, much bigger than Mad Men. It was a massive hit and it kept building. And so the show people came back and said, hey, you know, what's the deal? We want to keep making this great show. That's the biggest hit you've ever had. Don't nickel and dime us on this. We can't ask people, now that it's a big hit, to take a pay cut. You know, you're asking all the creatives and all the talent and all the behind the scenes people, hey, yeah, we know the show opened to record ratings. Now we'd like to cut your salary.
So they fired Frank Darabont because of it.
That's right. They came back and Frank Darabont and the people behind the show said, hey, come on, that's ridiculous. And AMC refused to budge. And finally he walked because he wasn't willing to tell everybody to take a pay cut on a show that was a blockbuster hit.
Well, the same thing was almost true of Matthew Weiner and Mad Men.
That's right. On that case, they wanted to cut the budget. They wanted to cut minutes out of the show to have more commercials. They wanted to give him less money. They wanted to trim characters. You could argue that the guy had gotten a little out of hand. He had 18 or 20 characters. They'd already fired some principal characters in years past. But he was finally saying, well, wait a second. you know, this is not making me happy.
Well, not only is it not making
serious back and forth.
Yeah, they did have a serious back and forth. And let's face it, that show made AMC.
Absolutely. But that doesn't make you a prophet. So I understand AMC not wanting to let things get out of control, but it's harder and harder to argue when these are what putting your network on the map, giving you massive increase in revenue, delivering you all the accolades and DVD sales that you could hope for, to say, hey, now we want to cut your budget. It's a pretty hard negotiating tactic. And in fact, he was looking at maybe walking away from the show. They would have had the disastrous step of, you know, putting somebody new in charge, which they've done on The Walking Dead. But with Mad Men, that seemed even more crazy. It didn't happen. They went to the brink, and then they both pulled back and made some compromises.
The same thing is true, I guess, of Breaking Bad. It was canceled, and it wasn't canceled. I have no idea what went on here.
Well, Breaking Bad wasn't canceled. I'm joking, because they announced that there would be a fifth and final season. So basically, they're saying we're in the midst of season four right now, and they've announced that there will be a fifth season, and that will be the show's last. And that's great, because the creators of the show and the stars and the talent have all been talking about not wanting to push the show too far. It has a very intense storyline about this man who has cancer and is dying and wants to get money for his family and becomes a drug dealer. He starts cooking meth, and he becomes more and more violent and evil as the show progresses. And they've always said that, you know, he's going to die at the end. We don't know whether it's cancer or whether it's, you know, another gang lord person killing him, but he will die. This is not a show that can run for 8 or 10 seasons. They've always wanted to have an end date. And so what they've done is they've said, okay, we are announcing our end date. This is what we have, which is great. They're being creative. They're ending the show in the right time. They want to end it a little too soon rather than too late. What happened was, you know, this show has won the Emmy for Best Actor 3 years in a row. And they came back to the show and said, hey, your fifth season, we only want 6 episodes.
What?
Maybe 8. They're cutting back their episodes from 12. And the people said, what?
No. They're cutting back by 12. No, wait. I thought had 16 episodes per season. No?
Mad Men does 12 episodes a season, 12 or 13.
Okay.
The first season was a shortened season of 6 episodes. The second, third, and fourth season were basic full orders for, you know, a cable show, about 12 episodes.
Okay.
They were coming back and saying, we're going to cut you back to 6 in your fifth season. And they said, what? And in fact, it got so serious as far as a lack of negotiation that the Breaking Bad people started shopping the show around to other networks. They said, yeah, you want to play that game? Fine. They started taking to other networks and say, who wants to take on Mad Men, you know, Breaking Bad? And AMC finally said, whoa, wait a second. And what they just came up with was a 16-episode order, but this would be the final season.
Well, so, you know, it does seem like if this is kind of going on with every show, all of this turmoil with every show and these negotiating tactics with every show, it seems like it may be an issue with management.
Exactly. Well, absolutely. You always want to have a good budget, but you can't put a show on and say, all right, here's $3.2 million to make your first season, and then the show's a big hit, and you say, all right, now we're cutting your budget. How does that make any sense? What happens is the show's a hit, you give them more money. At best, you give them the same, but you certainly don't cut them back. So you've got a show that's a creative success like Breaking Bad to say, oh, we only want 6 episodes next season. What the heck? That's not how it's done. Financial sense, you don't go forward, but you don't insult them by cutting their episodes, or you don't say, hey, we want you to fire half the staff and get the rest to take pay cuts and cut half your characters.
Well, Sci-Fi took that approach. They said, you know what? We're not going to cut your budget. We're not going to cut your, you know, staffing. Here's what we'll do. We'll just cancel you. And that's exactly what they did with Eureka. Although at first they said, no, it's going to be renewed. No, it's not.
Well, what happened was a person closer to the show at the network said, hey, they're coming back for another season. But then the higher-ups hadn't actually approved that yet. And they said, actually, we're not bringing the show back. So that was a little unfortunate. Fans got a bit of a head-spinning turn. But the turmoil isn't done at AMC, I should say. They have another show called Hell on Wheels, which debuts in November. It's a Western, sort of like Deadwood. And it's about the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. I've seen the pilot. It's terrific. It's a terrific show. I can't wait to watch the whole season. I'm really looking forward to it. But one thing that you might notice is it's the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, and there are ex-slaves. It's right after the Civil War, so there are ex-slaves involved and ex-slave owners and people who fought on both sides in the war working on this railroad. But there are almost no Chinese characters. And if you know anything about the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, there were quite a few, and people are already complaining about it. So this looks like another quality show from AMC, so all credit to them. They're creating shows people care about. But it looks like this one, even before it gets out the starting gate, they might have a little PR problem.
And then, of course, you turn to the broadcast networks, who are doing kind of what Hollywood studios are doing. They're taking old material and trying to make it new again. CBS is ordering a script for Bewitched, which of course was a big series. I don't know, was it the 60s or 70s? I want to say 60s.
60s, yeah. I mean, it was even black and white, the first episodes. Yeah, I mean, if you look at AMC, and we're giving them grief for the show, you know, for their back and forth with the creators, but all their shows feel very fresh, very different, very new. If it's a genre we know, like zombies, it hasn't been done on TV, or if it's a Western, it's one that's very rare on television. I'm sure they wouldn't want us to refer to Hell on Wheels as a Western, by the way. It's a drama. But then you look at CBS doing Bewitched, and you think, eh. You look at ABC, they're doing a TV adaptation of The Lincoln Lawyer, the Matthew McConaughey film, and The Nanny Diaries, which was a book and a film. And it just feels like the same old, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. You're right. Although I'm going to give credit to, I don't even know what network this is on, but there was a story in the Edmonton Journal about ex-porn stars who are forming a band and they're doing a reality series on the band.
Well, you've got a little backwards. They've made a reality series, and so they formed the band so they could have something to film for the reality series.
Oh,
this
okay.
is sort of a prefab, you know, monkeys type situation. Just nothing. It's porn stars, some who can sing and play. They had trouble finding a drummer, but they found one. They're out on tour. They don't really know each other. They don't really like each other. The lead singer has already quit, though they're hoping to do a season two. And it's not playing on anything. It's not playing in Canada, and it's on MAV TV in the U.S., which I've never heard of. But they get a little press because it's adult film stars on a reality TV series, much like the Playboy TV series. What was that called? They didn't have a Playgirl
thing. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they've had a couple little naughty things involving adult film stars. They had the show about people working in the adult film industry. They have reality. They have that. It gets you attention. Did it put MAV TV on the map? No, it hasn't. But there you go.
Were you referring to The Boy Next Door?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, you know, ultimately, I found it kind of interesting that you had, first of all, you had Bree Olson, who was, involved in the whole Charlie Sheen mess. She's somehow involved in this. I guess she plays the manager. And the funniest part was that they were having trouble finding porn stars that could actually play music. I thought, well, you didn't see that coming. You decided to go into production on this show called Tight, that with that premise, and you didn't foresee that maybe porn stars don't know how to play music.
Right. So there's no end to the lengths people will go to try and do something different and get attention, you know, porn stars making music, you know, anything you can do to get your, show popping up among the 700 channels and thousands of TV shows that are on cable these days.
Well, you'd think that, the Labor Day telethon for muscular dystrophy, you'd think that they would want Jerry Lewis to come back. He is apparently going to be retiring this year, and he won't be hosting it at all. He's hosted this thing for, 50 years?
Well, he's been semi-hosting it with other hosts now. He's frail. He's older. He hasn't been up to the task of doing it. It only lasts like a long day rather than the 2-3 day marathon it used to be. But I mean, of course they would like him back, assuming he's physically capable of it. He's chosen to retire and step down, and he hopes it will continue on with other hosts, though they haven't named who they might do next year.
Okay, so because originally the story was that the Muscular Dystrophy Association was just saying, he's not doing it, period. Almost as if they had fired him, but I guess it came out that he actually was stepping down and retiring.
Yeah, no, he hasn't even done it. He hasn't even done it full time anymore. It's been about 45 years, and he started in the year I was born, 1966, and he ends singing, "You'll Never Walk Alone." But he's 85 years old, and he's still going to be involved with the Muscular Dystrophy Association. He's raised like more than $1 billion for them, and it's from what I understand, it's all good natured and happy, and just a time for it to end.
Well, now, what did you make of this whole story about Bert and Ernie of Sesame Street? Apparently, this is, word on the street has it, they are just friends, that they are not gay, and they won't get married. I didn't know that they, was even a chance of them getting married.
Well, now it's legal. Some people started a silly online social network thing. I think it was a Facebook page or something saying, hey, Bert and Ernie should get married. But Sesame Street has always said they're just friends who room together and that they're not a gay couple. And they're not meant to be a coded gay couple, and that's just the case.
Oh.
So it's just, some people having fun out in the real world. You saw it sort of played out completely in the Broadway musical Avenue Q, where two roommates, one of which was closeted and gay, and that was sort of fun. But Bert and Ernie are just friends. They've always said so, and sometimes friends are just friends.
So it's not a big deal then?
Nope, it's a big whoop.
Ah, okay. So, well, then maybe we should move along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we look at the top news stories of the week and decide whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story, watch out, Broadway. Here come the Weinsteins. Broadway is used to larger-than-life personalities, so it shouldn't be overwhelmed by the fact that the Weinstein brothers are focused on turning their library of hit films into Broadway musicals and dramas. They've got their eye on 8 to 10 properties with Chocolat and Cinema Paradiso as frontrunners, and Finding Neverland already being workshopped. Is the arrival of the Weinsteins on The Great White Way a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal in a way. There's a lot of money to be made on Broadway, and people recognize that now, you know, especially with shows touring. They've got a big, valuable catalog. And when you look at Broadway, there are 11 shows out of, I think, like the 20 shows that are on Broadway right now based on movies or TV shows. Wicked, The Lion King, Spider-Man, Mary Poppins, Phantom of the Opera. You know, these all are well-known properties that have been Billy Elliot. You know, they've been the Addams Family. They've been movies, Sister Act, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. You go on and on. You can see a lot of movies or things that were big hit movies becoming Broadway musicals.
But wait a second. Isn't that kind of like a new trend? I mean, it's, back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, it was going the other way around. You'd have a hit musical or a hit drama that became a movie.
I'd say it was, it was the 30s and 40s before you really had anything beyond just reviews, you know, shows that were just a song and a dance and a bit of humor. So, you know, in the 20s and 10s, they were mostly just reviews, very flimsy plots, if at all. It's not terribly new, though. There have always been movies that became plays and plays that became movies and books that became plays. And, you know, it's always been back and forth. You know, it's certainly very notable today, but it's always happened that way. Hollywood has always made sequels, and everybody's always fed off everybody else in a cannibalistic way. So I don't think it's a new idea that movies become musicals. But you're right. It was more of the trend the other way around, which, you know, you see in War Horse. War Horse is a children's book that became a terrific play that's played in West End and is now a big hit on Broadway. And that's becoming a movie with directed by Steven Spielberg, and that'll be out this Christmas. And on the other hand, you have Catch Me If You Can, which was a terrific movie. I think it was one of Leonardo DiCaprio's best roles. It became a Broadway musical, and unfortunately, it did not click with audiences. I liked it more than most people. I think the lead, Aaron Tveit, is great, and it closes on September 4th, long before it should have.
Yeah, after 170 runs. So, I mean, runs, listen to me, 170 performances.
Yeah, it flopped.
The Hatfield and the McCoys are coming to the History Channel. One of the most famous rivalries since the Montagues and the Capulets will be brought to life in a fictional miniseries for the cable channel. But will the feuding be just on camera? Kevin Costner and Bill Paxton will be playing competing heads of the families. And the real jaw-dropper is the director, Kevin Reynolds. He and Costner became friends on the small indie film Fandango. Then they teamed for the out-of-control disastrous Robin Hood remake, with Costner siding with the studio, locking horns with Reynolds out of the editing room, or I guess he locked Reynolds out of the editing room too, and he delivered his own cut of the film. Reynolds vowed never to work with Costner again. Then they reunited on, wait for it, Waterworld, another disaster, on which they feuded bitterly, and Reynolds again lost control of his own movie. And now they're working again. I guess fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me, fool me three times, big deal.
It's Hollywood.
You're in Hollywood. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, it just, my jaw dropped. I've read so many stories about the travails on Robin Hood and Waterworld. The idea that they're working together again. It's nice. I hope it goes well, you know, but it's kind of hilarious.
George Lopez has been canceled. Lopez launched his show on TBS, attracting about 910,000 viewers at 11 p.m. Then he got booted to midnight, with Conan taking over the 11 p.m. slot. Conan barely moved the needle, pulling in 1 million viewers a night. At midnight, Lopez's audience shrank dramatically to an average of 543,000. TBS says the cost of creating the show was a big factor in canceling it. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I think it's unfair. I think Lopez got screwed. He was a game player on all this. He was, you know, encouraged Conan to come, and he's paying the price. I mean, Conan gets $10 million a year. Lopez gets $3.5 million. Conan owns his own show. The Lopez show is owned by TBS. Conan did not bring in a big new audience like he should have, and he starts at 11, whereas George Lopez starts at midnight. He's dealing with the middle of Jay Leno, David Letterman. He's got, you know, Craig Ferguson coming on and all the others. So he's in the heat of the late night world, whereas, you know, Conan gets the advantage of starting at 11 p.m. I think Lopez did his job, and I don't even know if it makes financial sense to me. You know, if you had a choice, you'd probably dump Conan and go back to Lopez.
Bring it on! That's what the screenwriter of the hit cheerleading movie franchise is saying to her studio. She's been working on a stage musical adaptation of the comedy Bring It On, starring Kirsten Dunst, for years, only to discover that the production company Beacon is launching its own Bring It On the musical in a four-city tour starting in October after a short run in Atlanta. The Writers Guild of America filed a claim on behalf of screenwriter Jessica Bendinger to stop the tour, stating that Bendinger must give approval for a stage version based on the quote-unquote separated rights provision, one of the most notoriously long and convoluted parts of a contract. It alone stretches on for dozens of pages. The musical about to tour is being co-produced by Universal, while Bendinger has been working on her own stage version with Mark Platt, the former head of Universal, and a backer of the Broadway mega smash Wicked. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, speaking of movies being turned into musicals, I think it's a big deal. People got to look at their contracts. Surely, you know, is she that confused about what her rights are? How can they think they can make a movie based on her movie without her being involved in some way? They also screwed her out of the sequels, the three straight-to-video sequels that they made on Bring It On. So it's interesting. This provision is based on the story that she created, which is a little better than having it being based on the screenplay that she wrote. Because any changes that they make, her rights to this musical, to this adaptation of the property, are based on the story that she wrote, not on the actual specific screenplay. So even if they change stuff around and add things, that doesn't detract from the fact that it's all based on the original characters and idea that she created for the movie, which is where the story, you know, resides. So it's interesting. She had a great quote. She said, imitation is not the sincerest form of flattery. Compensation is.
Oh, that's a great quote. Yeah. You know, she's actually a friend of mine on Facebook. I should have invited her to come on the show and talk about it.
Oh, well, good luck with her cause.
If Oprah can have her own cable channel, why not Tyler Perry? Hey, why not Michael Giltz? Why not everybody? That's the thinking of Lionsgate, which is looking to launch Tyler Perry TV, drawing upon the movies, plays, and TV shows of the wildly prolific mogul. No word on when it will launch, compatible programming they might include, or any other details. Is the Tyler Perry channel a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I, you know, somehow the Oprah channel made sense to me. This seems like a stretch to base a whole channel around Tyler Perry. As long as they're bringing in other stuff that they think fall under the Tyler Perry brand or in the worldview that he has, you know, you're competing with BET, you're competing with OWN, you're competing with a couple other things. But, you know, he's creating successful programming for TBS. Why not do it for his own cable channel? Yeah, but on the other hand, look at it this way. Oprah has created 4,500 hours of programming after 25 years of The Oprah Show. And that doesn't include all the spinoffs like Dr. Phil. You could program her cable channel with just The Oprah Winfrey Show 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for half a year without doing a single repeat.
Wow.
Tyler Perry, in contrast, has created 190 hours of programming. That's a lot, but that's all. And that does not include the upcoming sitcom he has for TBS called For Better or Worse.
You know what I see in that network's future? Lots of infomercials.
That's true. Right. So see, he has about 250 hours of programming created so far versus her 4,500. That's she has 20 times as much hours of programming. You know, his, you'd have to start repeating after just 10 days. So he does not have the library to fill a cable channel. So, okay, you've got his name, you've got new material he can create, but how's he going to fill it up? What's he going to show?
Hollywood loves Sure Things, so even the possibility that Mike Myers will be bringing back his Austin Powers character for a fourth movie is big news. The website HitFix says it's a done deal that Myers will be making a fourth Austin Powers movie for New Line, but doesn't provide even any anonymous sources, not a single one. The Hollywood Reporter says Myers is close to a deal, but hasn't committed yet, and that the actor is famously tentative about doing so. In any case, with no script written and no start date, it's probably at least 2013 before someone's going to get shagged, baby. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop because until it starts filming, I won't believe it. Mike Myers takes his time. So, you know, I'm sure an Austin Powers movie is in his future. Why wouldn't it be? He doesn't have a lot else going on, and it's still a, you know, good character, and he's given it enough rest that I think it's fresh and people will be happy to see Austin Powers return. But, you know, he takes his slow time. He's the Terrence Malick of comedy. So I won't believe it until it's actually filming.
First there was John and Kate. Then there was John and Kate plus eight. Then there was just Kate plus eight. And now the Learning Channel has canceled Kate's reality show, and Kate plus eight is no more. Yes, the once red-hot property about a couple raising a whole slew of children has faded into the sunset, with TLC promising to catch up with the family with an intermittent series of specials down the road. Is the cancellation a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's the definition of big whoop.
Ah, okay. Well, that's kind of interesting. Speaking of kind of interesting, Brett Ratner is co-producing the next Academy Awards ceremony. Or should that be, Brett Ratner is co-producing the next Academy Awards? Yes, the man behind the Rush Hour franchise who has never been nominated for an Oscar, the man who has never even been invited to the Vanity Fair Oscar party, is going to be in charge this year. Why? Because he loves comedy, and the Academy wants the show to be fun. Well, one decision just got a whole lot easier. Billy Crystal told fans that doing a cameo at the Oscars earlier this year gave him the itch to host the show again. We assume the phone call has already been made. So is Ratner as the Oscar honcho a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because it affects the Oscars, and we care about that. Billy Crystal saying he wants to host again is an even bigger deal. That solves your biggest problem right there. But it's a bizarre, ridiculous choice. Not because of any ill feelings I have towards Brett Ratner, but he has no experience in this. This is a live television variety show. Brett Ratner has zero experience in live television or variety shows or specials or anything of that nature. He's a film director. There's nothing in the skill set of creating a movie like Rush Hour that relates to putting on a live three-hour television extravaganza.
So you're saying taking two non-comedian, non-stand-up comics or television show hosts with no experience whatsoever and putting them on stage at the Oscars was a bad idea, and thus doing the same thing behind the camera, not a good idea either.
Any one element, you can roll the dice and try something new. And, you know, it's not that you have to have done the Tonys or the Grammys or the Emmys in order to be eligible to do the Oscars. But some experience is nice. Have you done live theater? Have you done anything live? I mean, have you filmed a concert, you know, and captured it live? I mean, some experience is helpful. So, yeah, any one element, the host or this or that, you can take a gamble. But somebody should have some experience on what you're talking about. And the guy in charge is the one area where you probably shouldn't try a newbie.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Well, maybe they're just trying to create a train wreck and to get everybody to watch, and they're starting off on the right foot.
It's working.
Some actual good news for the music biz. Live Nation, the ticket selling site that merged with Ticketmaster last year, see our previous episode on that subject, says attendance is up 4% at their shows for the first half of 2011, and profits are up 20%. They credit higher ticket prices for premium seats, along with lower prices for lawn and less prominent seats, along with a partnership with Groupon that put bums in seats to the tune of more than 400,000 last-minute sales. That's a lot. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. We're still in a recession, so any uptick in attendance and profit is a good sign. And, of course, by bums in seats, I was using the British term for bums, you know, people. I didn't mean homeless people were getting into concerts. Though, if they have the money and want to go, why shouldn't they?
Well, because they don't have the – oh, well, you just said if they have the money. Yeah, okay, that would make sense.
So that's good news for the music biz, and we have some more interesting, upsetting news for the music biz and inside baseball, don't we?
Well, yes, indeed, Michael. We are going from some good news in the music industry to, well, I don't know whether it's bad news. It's certainly concerning news. During Inside Baseball, Inside Baseball is where we analyze the behind-the-scenes deals and machinations that have the industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Today, we have Larry Roeder, a culture reporter for the New York Times, who wrote a fascinating article, something I had no idea about, called Record Industry Braces for Artist Battle Over Song Rights. And just the headline alone made me want to read it. Larry, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, you wrote this story about, I guess, copy the song, 35-year-old songs going back to their original writers and owners. This was
right.
A provision of the 1976 Copyright Act. And didn't people foresee this problem coming?
Well, some people did, yes. I mean, the problem of is related in some aspects to technologies that didn't exist in 1978 when this law actually went into effect. But the question of ownership of songs was foreseeable. And in fact, you know, I had one source that I interviewed for the story say to me, you know, I've had this date circled on my calendar in red for 35 years. Because if you're a songwriter or a recording artist, you know, you look upon this question of what's called termination rights, the right to reclaim ownership of your creations. you view this as a form of liberation from the major record labels.
Yeah, and to explain to people what we're talking about, what happened was when they put in a new copyright law, they created this right that after 35 years, dating from 1978, artists can invoke a termination right. And in a sense, will they reclaim their masters or simply the rights to the songs that they've written for albums? And that's sort of shutting out the record labels.
It depends. I mean, one answer is both. You know, if you're a songwriter, you get the rights to the song back. If you recorded a song, your own or somebody else's, then you're entitled to get the actual master recording back. So it covers both the writing of the songs and the recording of songs.
Hmm. And the reason we're talking about this today, if you can do the math, 35 years after 1978 is 2013, but you can start to invoke this right in 2011 and start the process. In fact, you have to start within a certain number of time or you lose that right. So we're already seeing some artists start to reclaim songs, such as, you know, file the appeal to do so, such as Bob Dylan, Tom Petty, Bryan Adams, Loretta Lynn, Kris Kristofferson, Tom Waits, and Charlie Daniels are some of the people you mentioned in your article.
Right, right. And, you know, there are other people that I tried to get them to talk about what they're doing or have done, such as Bruce Springsteen and Billy Joel. And, you know, they didn't want to discuss the matter. So we don't know whether they have invoked termination rights or whether renegotiated contracts that they've signed over the years already give them rights. This is a very kind of secretive issue that neither the record labels nor many of the artists wanted to talk about, with the exception of Don Henley of the Eagles.
Right, and he's also, I guess, I'm going to botch this, but he holds an official position with the, like, I want to say the Songwriters Coalition. Or some,
it's the recording, the Recording Artists Coalition,
right? Okay.
Which he and Sheryl Crow were, you know, instrumental in founding back in 1999, when the RIAA tried an end run around the law to insert a phrase that would have, in essence, made recording artists employees of the labels. And, you know, Henley and Crow and others got wind of this and went to Congress and lobby and got that provision overturned, which is pretty significant in the situation we're in right now. Because if, in fact, recording artists and songwriters had been ruled employees of the labels, then they wouldn't have a leg to stand on. They would, the termination rights could not be invoked because these would be works for hire, in the same way that an actor is hired to make a film, or me as a journalist, the stories I write, they belong to my employer. They don't belong to me.
Right. Well, now, you said this was a somewhat secretive issue. How did you come across the subject? What brought it to your attention?
Just a couple of conversations I had with artists and managers, you know, casual, you know, not for publication kind of things. And I got to confess, you know, I was baffled the first time I heard the phrase termination rights. I had to have it explained to me. But very quickly, you know, once it hits you, you realize, holy mackerel, this is really a significant thing. You know, as one of the lawyers in my story said, you know, I quote him as saying he's the head of a termination rights study group at the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences. And he says, this is a, you know, for the record labels, this is a life-threatening phenomenon.
That's right. If you look at some of the albums that were released in 1978 that did especially well, the Grease soundtrack sold 8 million copies. Billy Joel's 52nd Street sold 7 million copies. The Rolling Stones' Some Girls at 6 million copies is their top studio album. Willie Nelson's Stardust, that sold 5 million copies. That's his top seller of all time. Kenny Rogers' The Gambler, 5 million copies. That's his top selling studio album. Springsteen sold 3 million copies of Darkness. The Who sold 2 million copies of Who Are You? I mean, the list goes on and on. Number one, you look at
that list. Yeah, and next year there's going to be some big ones too. You know, we don't know whether this applies to British acts or just American, but you've got Pink Floyd's The Wall next year. That's 23 million. And, you know, down the line, I mean, Michael Jackson's Thriller is what tied with the Eagles at 29 million for the best seller of all time. That's 5 years from now, I believe it's going to be. Yeah, 78 is also Van Halen, Boston. You know, the Cars debut. I mean, there's some really there's some records that really have had longevity that theoretically, at least, fall under the termination rights provision.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what the record label argument is. When the artist creates the album and then they have to pay for it, because the record label typically just loans the money and the artist has to pay it back out of the proceeds. So if you create it and you pay for it, their argument that even 35 years later you have no right to it seems a little hard to swallow.
Well, yeah, the courts are going to have to decide that, aren't they? I mean, I think that's where it's heading. I think the differences between the two sides are so significant, and the amount of money involved is so significant, that only a court is going to be able to resolve this through some sort of definitive ruling. And the truth of the matter is that behind the scenes, both sides are jockeying right now, waiting for a case with a set of facts that most strongly bolsters their position. You know, look for something to emerge. I mean, I've got a story that's running tomorrow that's a follow-up on one such case. But, you know, there's going to be others. There's going to be plenty of them because the subject is so complicated. You know, one other aspect that I've raised in the story is, okay, fine. Who is eligible to be the author of a recording? Is it just the musicians in the band? Is the producer? I mean, you can argue that a producer like Phil Spector is certainly the creator of the recordings, you know, as much, if not more so, than the people who sang them or the musicians who played them. What about the recording engineers? What about the guy that you brought in to sweeten the recording with a pedal steel guitar riff? You know, where does it end? And all this has to be sorted out.
It seems like it's to everyone's interest to get this to court kind of in an expedited manner. I mean, the uncertainty that this could create for 2 or 3 or 4 years while it drags through the system won't be helpful to the record labels or the artists. Seems like somebody will want to get this.
Or you know, iPod, you know, iTunes or people like that, you know, Amazon, because what we're heading towards is a situation where the record labels refuse to acknowledge that a termination rights claim has been filed. And so artists are going to administer the songs as if, well, they're mine. So if you're iTunes or Amazon or, you know, anybody else who's actually selling these tracks, who are you going to deal with? The artist is going to say to you, deal directly with me. The label's going to say, no, 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 I still own this song. You've got to deal with me. It could get very, very messy.
Well, I did want to actually ask about that. The termination clause, you have to 2 years in advance. And I don't know whether it's 2 years in advance.
Yeah,
of the
at least 2 years.
So
yeah.
Basically, it's 2 years in advance of the date that you would get it back.
Well, yeah, two years in advance of the day you want to get it back. So, you know, a recording issued on, let's say, January 1st, 1978, just to be hypothetical, you would have to have filed by January 1st of this year if you want to get it back on the very first date that it was eligible. But you've got this 5 year period, and the purpose of that is to allow, you know, the creator, to allow the songwriter or the recording artist to, if he or she so desires, sit down with the record label and say, I want better terms. I'm willing to keep this with you, but I want better terms. And if you can't get that as the creator, then you can say, okay, game's over. I want the song back. I want the master back. It's mine, and I'm either going to distribute it myself or I'm going to go take it to somebody else.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because that's where I was headed, is that record companies, they kind of have an infrastructure in place. They distribute the albums to record stores, although that's kind of fading, but they are at distributing them digitally to Amazon and iTunes and other digital outlets, and they also have an infrastructure in place for accounting and knowing who gets paid what and when. And so if you're Bruce Springsteen or you're Billy Joel or Tom Waits or any of these people and you get the rights back, how do you administrate that? How do you keep track of all that? There's no infrastructure in place that I know of that can handle all of that. I mean, certainly publishers maybe, but I just don't see how they're going
to... Yeah, on the publishing rights side, yeah, but the actual distribution of the music itself, unless you want to do it through your own website. I mean, you know, I've had artists say to me, that's something that I'm thinking about, that we're thinking about. You know, or you could start to see clearinghouses, the emergence of new distributors who would specialize in this. You know, we'll take care of it for you for a fee.
Kind of like SoundScan.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of different modalities that could be created, because this is a situation, as I said, very much in flux, and we don't know how it's going to play out. So there could be new players.
Here's one crazy repercussion I've thought about. If record labels lose this battle in the court system and artists are able to reclaim their masters, it's possible record labels could start to argue that albums go into the public domain quicker. They might say, all right, if we're going to lose the rights to it in 35 years, we'd rather have everybody have access to it, because then we can keep working with the albums that we have and be a trusted label to get them out to people. So instead of that 75-year window that they have now for a lot of movies, books, and albums, they might push to shorten the copyright laws.
Yeah, that would require action from Congress again, wouldn't it?
Oh, that shouldn't be too hard at all.
Yeah, I mean, I know that there are people in Congress who are interested in this issue and might want to revisit it. And if this drags on too long in the courts, because, you know, one of the lawyers I talked to for the story was saying to me, you know, I think this could go to the Supreme Court. That could take years. You want to short circuit something like that. And so maybe if Congress steps in with clarifying language, that's a way to resolve this quicker.
I knew nothing about this. Did you get any feedback from an artist or hear about somebody who said, wow, I had no idea I had my rights, you know, to this album like this? I mean, was this news to any artist?
Yeah, I mean,
that,
you know, on our website, we've got a Q&A I did with Don Henley.
Yeah.
And the very first point that he makes is that, you know, artists need to be informed of this. And if they don't, if their lawyers and managers haven't told them already, they're being done a disservice. And, you know, I talked to NAFTRA, who said to me that, you know, they have like over 10,000 members, and they're concerned that many of their members don't know that they have these rights. And, you know, Rick Karnes of the Songwriters Guild of America, he said the same thing. So, you know, they're glad to see this subject getting publicity to get the word out to artists and, so, you know, recording artists and songwriters who may not even have known that they do have this right.
Well, do you think some of these artists will use this, or their managers or whoever is representing them, are going to use this termination clause as a way of maybe not taking the rights back themselves, because let's face it, that could be an accounting and administrative nightmare, but instead just to push and get better deals with the labels themselves?
Yeah, that's one strategy that I know from talking to some people off the record is very much on the minds of several major acts that, you know, that are household names.
Wow. Well, I mean, it's a fascinating topic, and thank you very much for not only writing the story, but joining us here to talk about it. Now, Larry Roeder, a cultural reporter for the New York Times, these termination clauses could cost the record labels billions of dollars starting in 2013.
Yep. And, you know, I'm going to continue following it. I think there's going to be developments that, you know, we'll want to talk about again. This is just the start of a story, not the end.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
My pleasure.
Talk to you soon.
You know, one thing I want to mention, when we look at the list of some of the top albums that came out in 1978, 8 million copies, 7 million copies, 7 million, 6 million, 5 million. Obviously, some of that is over the years, like Willie Nelson's Stardust is a perennial bestseller. But boy, you look at where the record industry has fallen. We don't see those numbers anymore at all. You sell 2 million copies, you're probably one of the top two or three albums of the year in 2011, selling 5, 6, 7, 8 million copies. Those are the glory days, baby. Those days are long gone, which is one more reason why this is going to be so harmful to the record labels if they lose the rights to these albums.
Yeah, I mean, between piracy and now this, I mean, if you're a record label executive, you should probably be going back to school to learn another trade.
Yeah, I mean, your catalog is all you have left at this moment. So yeah. It's a fascinating story. I look forward to seeing more about it in the future.
Yeah, likewise. And, you know,
on the podcast.
Exactly. The podcast, which, when does the copyright on our podcast expire?
That would be, it's 2 years, so it's 2009, so it's 2044.
Well, actually, we released this through a Creative Commons license, so technically the copyright is based on a Creative Commons agreement. However, you can find out about our Creative Commons license or ways to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You could leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can find that information as well as ways to subscribe to our podcast on our website, showbizsandbox.com, and you can subscribe in iTunes. That's also where you'll find links to all of the stories we discussed in today's episode, as well as links to our Twitter account, which is twitter.com/showbizsandbox, or facebook.com, which is facebook.com/showbizsandbox. So come and join us there. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found over on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael can often be found, well, in New York City, but also on his website, michaelgiltz.com, where links to all of his writing for various outlets can be found. Some of my writing can be found at celluloidjunkie.com.
Now, and don't forget, it's August, and like the French, we're taking another week off.
Yes, so that's what I was just about to say. A programming note, we are taking another week off next week, so we will not have a podcast next week, but we'll be back the following week with even more and exciting entertainment news. So until 2 weeks from now, play nice.